thank you for joining us once again for Stuff We've Seen. I am Jim, and with me, as always, is my very special
and permanent
guest co-host, Teal.
Welcome.
How's it going, buddy?
I'm doing good. How are you?
Oh, I'm just groovy. Actually, no. Before we begin, a couple of housekeeping items from the last episode.
Yes.
First, King of Comedy, Sandra Bernhard's character is actually named Masha, not Marsha.
Interesting. Okay.
I think I just always assumed it was Marsha, and then I took a little gander at it this past week and discovered that it's Masha. So that's really strange.
Masha. Okay.
Yeah, she even has a license plate in her car on the movie. It says Masha.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh man, I haven't seen that movie in a long time. I need to see it again.
I watched a good portion of it in the past week. It's one of my favorites. And the second bit of housekeeping is the title is Aguirre, Wrath of God.
Yeah, it is Aguirre. Yeah.
I thought it was like Aguirre or whatever, but
I always thought it was Aguirre.
Yeah, sometimes people will say Aguirre or Aguirre, but in the film, they call him Aguirre.
Aguirre,
I watched it. Thank you again. This is one of the reasons why we're having the show. You made that recommendation, and I hadn't seen it since the 80s.
And
it was really good.
It's a really good film, isn't it?
Yeah, and one last piece of housekeeping on that. Some of the information that you had mentioned regarding
the I mentioned about the crew dying.
Yeah, this was really the other epic that he had done, Fitzcarraldo.
Right.
That had a very troubled production. They made a documentary about it called Burden of Dreams, which I watched just the other day on Filmstruck Criterion. And man, it's amazing this guy's will to make the film Fitzcarraldo after the stuff that happened during that film.
Yeah, and they have to move the boat, right?
Yeah, but that's, you know what? That is an issue, but so many other things happened. There's the middle of a tribal war on the border of like Ecuador and they have to shut down filming, build a different camp, work with different locals. And then at one point during the film, it gets shut down again because Jason Robards, the original star, gets dysentery and he has to leave. The doctor says, don't come back. And I'm sure Jason Robards was like, I don't want to come back.
Fine. I'm out of here.
But the other thing was that he had a sidekick who was mentally challenged and he was played by Mick Jagger. And the performance, I guess, was amazing. And when Jason Robards had to go, then the film had to get shut down. Mick Jagger was joining his Tattoo You tour.
Oh, and so they had to recast that too?
He said that Werner Herzog said that the performance was too good and he couldn't recast it. So they basically just left that character out. And the only footage that survives, which is just like a quick scene of this Jason Robards and Mick Jagger pairing is in the documentary Burden of Dreams because Werner Herzog didn't want to look back and he had all the footage destroyed.
Wow.
Yeah. So then, you know, he gets his old pal Klaus Kinski to take on the role and then things go on, but there's crazy incidents.
Kinski is crazy.
Yeah, but he doesn't come off too bad in this film.
Okay, so I've heard this story. I don't know if this is true or not or which film it's from, but that Kinski walked off set, quit the movie, and that Herzog went and found him and held a gun to his head.
I'm not sure. I have heard that story. I don't know which one it is, but I can tell you that when we go back to Aguirre, Wrath of God, one of the things – it's obviously German actors and there are some other nationalities as well in the cast and they're playing these Spanish conquistadors.
Yes.
And they're looking for El Dorado, the lost city of gold.
Lost city of gold.
Under Pizarro's instructions. And the only common language between all the various actors and the film crew was English.
Right.
So they spoke the dialogue for the most part in English. And then they had to have it translated in German because it's a German movie.
Because it's a German movie, right.
So you have, from an American standpoint, when you're watching this film, the voices don't match up, obviously. But they were speaking American, right, dubbed in German, but they're supposed to be Spanish conquistadors. It gets very confusing. But Klaus Kinski wanted a whole bunch of money to do his voiceover, so they got a Klaus Kinski sound-alike. And most people don't even know that it's not Klaus Kinski's voice in the whole film. So, you know, again, we're talking about, I think, in pretty obscure movies here, totally worth checking out. But
totally
now,
worth checking. I mentioned this last week, but The Butterfly. Now, do you know the scene I'm talking
it's
about?
It's towards the very end. And I think this could be something that maybe it had an impact on you when you were a kid seeing it. That
yes,
it just struck out because this movie was so strange. And I think one of the things that I got out of watching it, and again, I had really sketchy memories from seeing this, is it's shot open format, 35 millimeters. So it was 1:3:3.
Right.
And the film is mostly handheld. It feels like a documentary. And I think most times when you see a period movie, they're usually these Hollywood things with gorgeous costumes.
Yes.
Maybe they didn't really look like the period. Here, it almost has this low budget quality. The costumes,
it's very gritty.
Yeah, it's grainy, and the costumes almost look like they came from a theater company, but then they might almost be more authentic than like a Hollywood costume. It feels like somehow they took a documentary film crew and transported them in a time machine to when this happened.
Exactly. It's amazing about that moment with the butterfly is that it's not something that you could plan for. It's truly just a documentary moment that was captured and, you know, wasn't scripted, wasn't thought about. And it shows sort of how raw and spontaneous the film is in a way, and how that grittiness, that documentary grittiness, really comes across.
Things happen in the film when they're going down river. They're continually being attacked by natives.
Yes.
And when this stuff happens, there's not music cues. There's not dramatic buildup. You'll just have a guy on the raft who suddenly is leaning over and they're trying to figure out what happened to this guy. Oh, he's dead. Oh, look, he's got this tiny little arrow stuck in his throat. And the same thing happens several other times when they're attacked. It's very surreal. It kind of just happens very chaotically. And there isn't a lot of yelling or over drama. And you kind of feel like maybe this is the way something like this would happen.
It feels very realistic. You're right. It isn't those music cues. It's not trying to manipulate you emotionally. It's trying to deal with it in the most realistic way. And that realism, like you said, is actually kind of surreal.
When I watch Burden of Dreams, the making of Fitzcarraldo, and they were filming in some very similar areas, the tribal warfare gets out of hand. And one night, a few of the locals working on the film crew are hit by another tribe. So they attacked them with spears and arrows. And one of the crew, this actor, he got an arrow through his throat.
What?
Yeah. And they show him like getting the arrows out and then all stitched up. And another person got like the spear right through their side.
Oh, wow.
It's a crazy movie. And so this is on Filmstruck as well. But here's the shocking news of the day.
Yeah.
2 hours ago, I get an email, because I'm a subscriber to Filmstruck Criterion. Warner Brothers Digital and Turner, the companies that have Filmstruck Criterion, they're shutting it down.
Wait, what?
They're shutting the site down. November 29th is the last day for the service.
For Filmstruck?
Yeah. So I just joined in June, and I joined for a year, and they'll be prorating me and refunding my remaining months.
So what's going to happen to Criterion?
Well, so there's two things. The Filmstruck part was the Turner Classic Movies part.
Right.
And their entire, like, you know, library. And, man, they were putting all sorts of weird things. I mean, if you love older films, tons and tons of movies. And then lots of just other weird stuff. They would do, like, for instance, right now they're doing a Jacqueline Bisset homage. So you've got seven different movies that she's featured in. And a couple of weeks ago, they did a Steve McQueen one. And these are also the people that did our favorite journeyman director, Peter Hyams.
They did the Peter Hyams Festival.
And so I guess Warner's is working on some supersized digital streaming service platform.
Okay.
And HBO is going to be a big component of that.
And
so they've now pulled that. So once they pulled out, you're left with Criterion, which the Criterion films had lived on Hulu.
Right.
Not as extensive as what their streaming service was, but without the backing of Warner, they're gone.
That is really too bad.
Yeah, and they don't know, quite honestly, what they're going to do. It's really disappointing. I have seen so many films since I got this subscription in June. I just finished watching. I mean, what I'm doing is going back to some films that, like Aguirre, Wrath of God, I had seen many, many years ago. We start talking about it, and lo and behold, they have it. And then I get to watch, they say, you know, related titles. Oh, Burden of Dreams. I'd always wanted to see that. I'd heard it was great. Well, I got to watch it. Woman Under the Influence, the great John Cassavetes classic.
With Gina Rowlands.
Gina Rowlands. Heard about it for years. They don't show this on TV. I have never seen it on TV. They had it on Filmstruck or Criterion, and I watched it. And it took me a while. I'd watch it actually when I'd be like folding clothes and stuff because it is so brutal.
Yeah, it's not an easy film to watch at all.
You've seen it, right?
Oh, yeah.
I mean,
it's absolutely brutal. Yeah.
It's a devastating look at two people who are, I think the real struggle is who is more insane, Gina Rowlands or Peter Falk? And I was left thinking Peter Falk is actually worse than Gina Rowlands because
they're both pretty insane.
He victimizes her. And I guess that's really where the title Woman Under the Influence. She's under the influence of this very dominating man. And she obviously is mentally unstable. But it's those two performances and how they were able to be captured. I think that's why he was nominated for Best Director.
Absolutely. Yeah. The way he worked with actors and what he got out of them, not a lot of directors dig that deep.
No, I mean, I think this is when, you know, I think we'll talk about it in later episodes when we get maybe into discussing films of the 70s. But you had a lot of American directors clearly influenced by what they were doing in Europe.
Yes.
And, you know, when you see a Fellini movie, the actors are always so interesting to look at, and you're like, I don't see people like that in America. And maybe part of that is, you know, it's different nationalities. Maybe the director's just seeing something. And then you see a film like Woman Under the Influence, and you realize here's a director who is exploring those same types of real everyday looking people and getting like in your face with the camera so you can actually see their eye movements and their wrinkles.
Yeah.
And it also reminded me a lot of Bob Rafelson's film Five Easy Pieces.
Oh, yes. I can see that.
Where it's just, again, it's telling an American story about a working class guy who comes from actually a more affluent background.
Right.
So, you know, you have these two films, and then I recently, stuff we've seen, I recently watched on MGM, it's another thing that's on cable.
Right.
A movie I'd always wanted to see to add it to my list of Altman movies, California Split.
I have never seen it.
It is a really interesting film. Not a strong plot like a lot of Altman movies. He's more interested in delving into interesting characters and the side characters that they're involved in. And you get these weird performances and his wandering camera where you start to see somebody who might look like an extra and he has the camera follow them. And suddenly you're like, I think that person's going to come into the action. And then they do. And then they come out and it's, you know, the whole film is sort of grounded by these two performances from George Segal and Elliot Gould. But I mean, I got to tell you, I didn't love it. I had some problems with it, but it was, again, it was fascinating. The early 70s was this time where directors were starting to explore other things that the studio system did not allow them to explore. And people were actually going to the movies to see these films.
Yeah. yeah. People actually went to this theater to see them. And that's something that's changed.
Yeah. I mean, you know, we were talking a little bit about Star Wars last week. And again, we a lot of people will point to Jaws as the film that, you know,
right,
turned Hollywood into just this box office thing where everybody wanted a big box office success and movies have never been the same for the better because of it. And I actually think it was really Star Wars, because the week before Star Wars came out, and again, I mentioned that the Charles Theater in Boston, it was a three theater outlet. They had one big, huge house and then they had two smaller houses. Well, the film that was playing before Star Wars came out that May, Three Women by Robert
Altman.
Oh, yeah,
Three Women, the Altman film. Yeah.
And, you know, I just think that there was a time before Star Wars, Three Women, and the big sensation of that spring was Annie Hall.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, Star Wars comes out. And I can understand it. Every studio wanted a blockbuster success like that.
Yes. They saw those dollar signs and started chasing them.
You know, and I think then the couple of years it took before you started to really see those type of big event movies hitting the screens and packing the summer.
Well, and having those wide release patterns too, because even Star Wars had a more of a staggered release. I think that's why people focus on Jaws, is that it was the first really big, wide release.
Yeah, and it wasn't because the studios thought we have this monster hit on their hands. They thought, well, it's summer and we want to get it into many of those little theaters and drive-ins as we can.
Exactly. Yeah. So I think it released on more screens than any film before it at that point. But I don't quote me on that. That's something that should be looked up.
Yeah, and I mean, again, in Star Wars, you know, we're not covering new ground here, but the studios thought it was just a kid's movie and
You
know, it would play for a couple of weeks and that would be it.
They were really expecting Sorcerer to be the big hit.
Yeah. I mean, that's what the legend says. and I'm a little dubious of it because I can't see why they thought that movie was going to do well.
I can't either. It's not a terrible movie.
No, it's just, you know,
it's just a regular movie.
Exactly. And I just don't, I mean, I understand that, you know, Friedkin had done The Exorcist in 73. And so maybe people were expecting his next big film was also going to be a blockbuster or something.
We could get stuck on Star Wars really for the rest of every future episode. We could just talk about Star Wars.
We'll work it in along with Peter Hines every single episode. I want to go back in your film list, because I don't feel we really got to talk about some of the aspects that I want to delve into with Dawn of the Dead.
Yes.
Obviously, you and your sister, latchkey kids, roaming the streets of Texas, nowhere to go. Hey, here's a theater. Hey, here's Dawn of the Dead. No one's going to stop us.
One's going to stop. Well, and we didn't even really know what it was about. We just saw the poster that said, when there's no more room in hell, the dead will walk the earth. And we said, okay, let's go to that.
Now, did your parents, like, when you go see this, do your parents know you're going to see this movie?
No.
Okay, so do you tell them afterwards, guess what, Mom, Dad, I saw Dawn of the Dead?
Yeah, but they didn't even know what it was.
So would you see, and how old do you think you were when you saw this?
Probably 10 or 11.
Okay, so it was being shown as a some kind of re-release because
it was in, this dollar theater that was a few blocks away was second run. So it was stuff that had been out for a year or so.
And had you seen a lot of horror and zombie type
movies? I was terrified of horror movies. I was terrified of seeing blood in horror movies. The idea of blood in a movie gave me nightmares.
But did you think going into this, oh, I'm in trouble?
I didn't really know what it was. But I was terrified of horror movies. I just absolutely, I would have nightmares over the smallest things. Do you remember this Sherlock Holmes movie, Murder by Decree?
I know the title, but I have not seen it.
I'm going to look it up, and it'll probably turn out to be directed by Peter Hyams.
No. I was always obsessed, again, with movies that I couldn't see. One trailer that I would see at the drive-ins, the whatever particular summer it was, and it scared the crap out of me, was Audrey Rose.
Oh, and I never saw it.
Ginger and I watched it several months back. It was on. And again, we both had wanted to see it. It's a little dated, let's put it that way.
Okay.
Occasionally it does slip into our conversations because there's some funny stuff, and it has interesting performance from, why is the name escaping me there? Hannibal Lecter.
Oh, Anthony Hopkins.
Anthony Hopkins, before he became Anthony
Hopkins. Some of his early performances are pretty interesting, yeah.
So anyways, you
So Dawn of the Dead, I'm terrified, absolutely terrified of horror movies. We walk into this, don't really know what it is. And, immediately there's just full-on gore, like, in that opening scene.
Yeah, it starts off, from when I remember seeing it, I had wanted to see it for a long time. But, I was sort of reader of Fangoria by that point. And once video, and we had a store that was nearby that was carrying it, I was able to convince my parents, we should go see rent Dawn of the Dead for me. And I remember my dad, he would put in any of these movies.
Sure.
I'm watching it with him. I kind of wanted to watch it on my own because I was like, I didn't think they were going to watch it. And I know it's got a lot of gore in it, and they may say you can't watch this. But we sat down, and it starts with the raid of this tenement building.
Yes, exactly.
And it's like, it is very violent and bloody, but I was really confused thinking, this isn't exactly what I thought it was going to be.
So what happened to me in that opening sequence was there is quite a bit of blood in that opening sequence. It's pretty violent. There's a lot of gunshots and stuff. It didn't freak me out. And I think it's because the blood was so over the top that it didn't look realistic to me. It's not necessarily that it looked fake. It's just that it was so in your face and so big, and that it didn't creep me out in the same way. It was gross, but there was something operatic about it, something larger than life that made it less. It got under my skin less somehow, and was something more that I could just observe and look at and say, wow, that's creepy and gross and kind of funny, and maybe I'll cover my eyes. But it wasn't scary like this Murder by Decree movie, which gave me nightmares when I was 8.
Well, I think that's the interesting thing about horror. My son, my oldest, he's 10, and he's starting to go through that now, that discovery process. What you think of horror is going to be when you're a little kid. And then you want to see these movies. Oh, someone said it's a great horror movie.
Yeah.
And you're like, but it wasn't scary. And coming to understand that a great horror movie doesn't necessarily mean scary.
Right. But it's somehow titillating or exciting, or it involves you emotionally in a different way than, say, a drama. It triggers different emotions.
Yeah. I'm watching, I have a whole mixed bag of history with horror movies, going from being that 10 to 14 range when all I wanted to do was see a horror movie.
Yes, and I was a Fangoria reader then too.
And then, you know, then it became one of my least favorite genres only because it feels so recycled, never scary. I very rarely am ever scared.
Yeah.
And nobody's ever seems to be able to do anything original. But it doesn't mean I don't like horror. It just it has to be something that's new and different. And one thing, it's not a film, but I'm watching now, and we're halfway through, is the new Netflix series, The Horror of Hill House, or The Haunting of Hill House.
Yes, The Haunting of Hill House, yeah.
I have to give the filmmaker major applause. He's doing some things that I don't typically see in horror films, how he's going about scaring you.
Yeah.
And I don't find it scary. I do find the show creepy, but my wife she's freaking out.
Okay, that's great.
And it's a great, I mean, there was one scare in one of the early episodes, I think it's episode 3, that I was excited watching it. Like, I was like, yeah, now that's what I want to do. Like, Ginger's on the couch, like, curled up, going, ah! And I'm like, damn it, that is awesome. Because it's not about music cues and jump scares.
Right.
And, you know, there's been a whole thing where people are discovering, sprinkled throughout all of the various scenes in the show, there are hidden ghosts.
And oh, cool.
They're not there. The characters don't necessarily see them. You might not even see them.
Okay, so this brings me to another movie that we both have on our list, The Shining.
All right, let's talk about The Shining.
If we're talking about hidden ghosts, if we're talking about scary things, The Shining. You saw it when you were 10. I saw it probably around the same age. It was not what anyone thought a horror movie should be.
I would agree. Well, okay, so set it up for me. How do you go about seeing The Shining?
Okay, so The Shining for me was another college theater one. Dropped off on a Saturday afternoon, and The Shining comes on.
I know your parents, and with each conversation that we have regarding these movies, I'm getting a little bit more concerned.
Yeah, my parents had no idea that that's what we were going to see. But didn't know that's what we were going to see.
You did, and you're just like, we're like, I don't know, The Shining. It's like about people clean windows or something.
No, we were literally just dropped off at the theater to see whatever was playing. It was like babysitting.
Wow. So
so The Shining, and it's kind of a long movie. It's paced weird. It has those pauses. That's something that really struck me at age 10 was the days coming up on the screen. Because it gives you that feeling that you're trapped in it too. And like, okay, here's another day. Some more time has passed. We're in this dark place in the winter. We're trapped in here with these people. And then there's all just this crazy stuff. The twins, the creepy rotting corpse woman in room 237. And I think also what's really striking about seeing The Shining as a kid is that there's a kid in the movie. And so you have this connection to it in a way that it's almost like a kid's movie. It's not a kid's movie, but there's a kid main character. So as a kid, you identify with that character in a different way than I think seeing the movie as an adult, you connect with that character. I really felt like Danny going around on the big wheel in the Overlook Hotel.
One of the things that Kubrick knew was getting that camera down at his level. You really do feel like you're experiencing this story from the kid's perspective anytime that he's involved in the action.
Yes. Yeah, the camera's down at his level, and he is, in a way, the most the most well-rounded character, and maybe the most grounded, I think, because both Nicholson and Duvall's characters are really big. In typical Kubrick fashion, their performances are large. But Danny is much more grounded in a way. I think he's like the emotional center of the film. He never loses it the way they do.
We both lived through The Shining when it opened. The movie was not a success. I think a lot of people think, oh, this is the greatest horror movie of all time. It's got this amazing reputation, but it was not quite a bomb, but reaction to it was not pretty. And
it was the same as every Kubrick film. People are baffled by it when it comes out. They don't know what to do with it or what to make of it. They think it kind of fails on a lot of levels. And it's only through repeated viewings that you start to realize how good it is.
I came to the film 6 months before it opened, January of 1980. My mom let my sister and I go to the movies by ourselves. This was the first time I was in charge. And so it was a big deal for me. And we were seeing Disney's The Black Hole.
Ooh.
Yeah, the old Black Hole. For me, the most significant part of going to see The Black Hole was I'm going with my sister and no parents, and I got to be careful to make sure nothing happens to us. And we go into the theater and the previews were just starting. And we walk in and the theater wasn't very full because The Black Hole had been out for several weeks. And all I saw was this image on the screen of a hotel lobby. And for a second there, I thought that we were in some other film. I didn't see the credits go up as they go in that famous preview. And I had never seen a teaser before. I didn't really recognize this as a movie trailer. And I just saw this hotel lobby and I quickly said to my sister, I don't know if we're in the right film. Hold on. I got to go out. And so I go out and check the marquee to make sure that we were in the Black Hole again. And I go back in. So I must have missed several of the credits that went up that says, you know, coming soon or The Shining and based on the book by Stephen King. And I'm watching and nothing seems to be happening. And I'm like, what is this movie? And then the blood starts coming out of the elevators and it fills up. And when you're a kid, you don't necessarily pay attention to all the details. I just saw this movie, The Shining, and I thought, well, I got to make a mental note. I don't want to see that film. That looks horrible.
Boring grown-up movie.
Yeah, it's what it looked like. So flash forward several months. We're now at the very beginning of June of that year. My uncle took my sister and I to see The Empire Strikes Back. And we got to see it in Boston at the Charles Theater. It was an exclusive engagement there for weeks. It had been the number one movie on my list for months and years.
Right, of course.
You know, since we saw Star Wars, we waited for this sequel. And my father didn't take me into town when it was an exclusive engagement to see it. I thought for sure I would be the very first kid to see The Empire Strikes Back. And instead, there was another kid in our class who got to go see it. So I had to wait.
Oh, how disappointing.
It was awful because he's the first person to come up to us afterwards, like, oh, you saw The Empire Strikes Back. Whoa, was it good? Well, it was okay. It really wasn't as good as Star Wars. And Darth Vader is Luke Skywalker's dad. And I'm what? I thought he was just making a joke because it didn't make any sense to me. Because I'm 10 years old, and in my Star Wars mind, Darth Vader was an evil robot.
Right.
I didn't think of him as a person under there, you know. Now, of course, you know, it's a different story, but I just it didn't make any sense to me. So I thought he was pulling my leg, but it stayed in my back of my brain and trying to figure that out. Like, well, how could that be? That just makes no sense. We finally get to go. And this is the first film I ever saw in 70 millimeter. You know, there's a big advertisement playing at the Charles Theater, 70 millimeter, six tracks Dolby. I had no idea what 70 millimeter meant, but my uncle assured me it's like, oh, it's a film format. It's like for big screens and all these extra sound. So I was very excited about that.
Six track Dolby.
Yeah. Again, it just sounded good. And, you know, back in the day, a lot of theaters had no stereo. It was mono.
Right.
And Dolby was a fairly new thing. And theaters would tout, oh, this film is playing in Dolby. So six track Dolby. Had no
idea. Six track Dolby.
Yeah, didn't know what it meant, but I was excited and got into the theater, and it was the biggest theater I'd ever seen in my entire life. And huge screen and these huge monster speakers at the front. And when the action started and the first trailer came on, it was for the Blues Brothers. And the sound blew me away. I was like, holy crap. And I was like, I got to see that movie, which of course was rated R. And I ended up not being able to see that until a few years later on cable. But the next trailer, and it's just this one of these memories that I just never will forget, was the full trailer for The Shining. And so we're seeing this trailer in 70 millimeter, super sharp and crisp with this amazing sound. And you're hearing like the score of the film. And I'm seeing images of Jack Nicholson using an axe through a door and then hopping through the winter scene in some kind of maze. And I sat back and I said, I don't know what I have to do, how I can convince my parents, but I need to see this movie. And of course it was rated R, and then the reviews weren't even that good. So I'm crushed because I had to see it. I didn't know who Kubrick was. I didn't know who Stephen King. I just had to see this movie, and I had to convince my parents to take me to this rated R film, and I worked on them for weeks and weeks.
Oh wow.
And weeks. And shortly after my 10th birthday, and then a couple weeks later, my sister, who's 2 years younger, her 8th birthday, I somehow magically came up with the right set of criteria for why it was important to my film development that I see this movie. And the whole gang of us, my mom, dad, and my sister.
Oh, they took your sister too.
Yeah, we all go to the local multiplex theater one afternoon and saw this film. And of course, it's my first radar movie, and then there's that scene in room 237 with a full naked lady.
Right.
And I think that my mom was just cringing at that point. And my sister, she wasn't really paying attention, so it didn't affect her.
Well, that's the thing. When you're young enough, these things don't affect you because you don't understand them. You're not really paying attention. It doesn't make a lot of sense.
And they weren't scared. So, we watched the whole movie. And I think I was the only one of the four that enjoyed it. But when you talked about these place cards that say, 6 weeks later or like one day, and then it gets closer and closer and closer to the action. I actually remember a couple of people in the audience by the time it said like, Tuesday, people were laughing.
Interesting.
Because
yeah.
It's like, oh, and I think my parents were like, get on with this movie. And I remember having this unsettled feeling the entire time watching it, not because the movie was scaring me, but I was worried that the pace of this movie was too slow and my parents were going to say, nothing's happening, let's go. And I was so afraid that they were going to take me out and I wasn't going to get to watch the whole thing. That's what made me uneasy. Although,
right, because it develops so slowly. And I understand that reaction of laughing when the days come up because it's so dramatic. And then it's like they're just sitting there watching television.
Well, that's the thing is that, the original first audiences to see the film in the theater, they a lot of times are the people that make or break. And yet what happened with The Shining is video comes along, new life. People watch this thing, and they suddenly, by the time I got to college, people were talking about, oh, The Shining, man, that is one of the scariest movies of all time. And I'd look at them, I'm like, are you crazy, really? I mean, it was good. But then I, of course, through my own love of Kubrick, I started to appreciate the film on deeper and deeper, deeper, deeper levels.
Yeah.
And that's what such great movies can do. There's the initial reaction that a theater going audience gives it and what critics might say. And then, time passes and either that film gets better with age or it gets worse.
Yeah.
And I think that why we criticize the film Oscars a lot of times,
they don't necessarily pick the movies that are going to last. Shakespeare in Love.
That's another program. Great Oscar injustices. We could talk about that. I mean, I just saw this movie, Woman Under the Influence.
Yeah.
And Gina Rowlands was predicted that year that she was certainly going to have the Oscar. And instead, it went to Ellen Burstyn for Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore, which I always liked her performance in that film.
Yeah, it is a good performance. But Jenna Rowlands does something beyond that.
Well, now I realize why she got it. It was the Your Due Award because she was nominated for The Exorcist and didn't win.
Right.
And she also was nominated for The Last Picture Show.
Right.
Didn't win. So okay. This is her third time. So I get it now, but it's an, I mean, to me, after watching that performance, there is no better performance that probably was the entire decade than Jenna Rollins' performance in Woman Under the Influence.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, so The Shining, I think that it impacted us. It made us look at, well, I certainly, whether or not we both knew who Kubrick was.
I didn't know at the time, but there was definitely not other movies like it.
Yeah, and I think that's what you and I picked up. Even as youngsters, we started to see, wait a second, films can be different, and there's somebody behind the curtain who's pulling
there's
the
somebody
strings
behind
making
the curtain
these.
Who's making this, and...
So that's interesting, because I just recently watched The Shining again on Netflix.
Yeah.
Beautiful print, by the way. And my wife and I watched it with our 10-year-old. Figurative tradition. He's loving horror movies.
Yeah.
Wanted to watch it. We watch it in two installments, and he enjoyed it. However, and this was a little disturbing, it kind of ended our experiment with horror movies. At the end, we're like, well, what do you think? And he's like, that's it? Jack Nicholson didn't get to kill the mom and the son? And we're like, what? That's the takeaway? That is the takeaway? You wanted him to kill everybody? Well, yeah, I mean, and we realized, we're like, you know, this movie, he's already learned about it. Through,
right.
I mean, there's, you know, I don't want to give anything away, but if you've watched Ready Player One, there's definitely a homage
right.
to The Shining. And there's like from The Simpsons on to other pieces of pop culture, he has been exposed to The Shining.
Well, the Here's Johnny moment turns up all over the place.
Yeah, so he suddenly, you know, he has familiarity and suddenly he's seeing this character. And then just a week before he watched this, he got his first taste of Jack Nicholson in The Witches of Eastwick, which
okay.
he went and saw with me at this 70mm film festival in Somerville, Massachusetts.
He hasn't seen Batman?
Oh, all right, and he had seen Batman, but you know... He didn't, when you don't know who Jack Nicholson is, and
right.
you see Batman and he's under that makeup, you don't make that Jack Nicholson connection. And I'm speaking
right.
from just a little kid who this is.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
He doesn't know, like we grew up knowing who Jack Nicholson was before we rarely ever saw his movies. And so he sees Witches at Eastwick and he really enjoyed it. And it was a packed crowd and everybody was getting into it. And I think he started to like that Jack Nicholson persona.
Right.
Because
he's rooting for him in The Shining.
because in The Witches of Eastwick, he's a devil and you kind of root for him. So now, and of course, I couldn't have made that connection when I'm watching it with him, that he would root for Jack Nicholson in a way that I didn't think. So I blame myself. But yeah,
that is hilarious. Yeah, no, that's exactly the opposite reaction you want.
Yeah, so maybe you know you hold off on your kids from seeing The Shining until they ask that they want to see it.
Yeah, no, I'm not definitely not lining it up. I think the only Kubrick film I've shown them so far is 2001.
And my kids have seen that as well. My oldest enjoys it, and my youngest, he enjoys parts of it.
Yeah. Well, my oldest saw when she was six, and she got bored. She thought, yeah.
Well.
I understand why.
Yeah, small screen, they saw it?
No, she saw it on a big screen.
Oh, she did?
Yeah.
Oh, geez.
At age six, but she got a little bit bored. You know, some of that stuff on the, that meeting they have on the moon base.
Is
really boring to a kid.
Yeah, but you know what's good? See, you got the first viewing, and that's the whole trick to 2001.
Yes, is get that first viewing out of the way so that you alter your expectations the next time. And you go, okay, maybe I am going to be bored. So you start looking for other things and start realizing, oh, wait, it's not boring at all. It's packed with all this really interesting stuff. It's just... A lot of it's so subtle and flat that you don't notice the first time.
Yeah, you know what? I'm going to stop you there. I don't want to get into 2001 because I think that it's a great topic for a future discussion.
Yes, yeah.
And, you know, here it is. The time flies.
Time
when you're
flies.
Having fun and there is no more
We didn't
no
even
more
get
time.
To talk about License to Drive.
No, but see, we have other films that we want to discuss. And I really do want to delve into a couple of... Your
Peter Hyams movies,
The Star Chamber. But I do want to hear about License to Drive, And there's another film, The Doors, that you have on your list that I'm kind of curious to hear
Which we
why.
saw together.
We did, and I want to hear why that made your list. But again, we run out of time. So hopefully you listeners at home or wherever you are enjoying these discussions. We're going to have more discussions. But as we start to piece together our carefully considered approach to social media, wanted to let you know that for now, if you have a question or a comment, you can send us an email at feedback@jimandteal.com. And Teal is spelled T-E-A-L for those who don't know. So feedback,
just like the color.
Just like the color. So feedback@jimandteal.com. And we'd love to hear from you. And again, in future installments, we'll have more news about other ways that you can experience the excitement
of our Peter Hyams discussions.
Yes, on stuff we've seen. So on behalf of Teal and myself, I wish you a good whatever.
Until next time.
All right. Goodbye.